Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, September 13, 2021. Secretary of State Antony Blinken defending the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, telling the House Foreign Affairs Committee there's no evidence that staying longer would have made the Afghan security forces or the Afghan government any more resilient or self-sustaining. But the secretary getting a lot of questions about how the withdrawal took place, the chaos the U.S. troops killed in the final days, Americans and vulnerable Afghans left behind, and now the terror threats that accompany a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. Security fencing going up again around the U.S. Capitol building in Washington ahead of a rally next Saturday in support of those arrested in the deadly January 6th attack on the Capitol during the counting of the presidential electoral college votes. U.S. Senate back from summer recess, a lot on the agenda, including a $3.5 trillion spending plan the Democrats are looking to pass without a single Republican vote, if they can all stick together, and a federal debt ceiling increase to avoid the first ever government default. President Joe Biden heading west, visiting Idaho and California to survey wildfire damage, arguing that the extreme weather calls for the climate change programs in his spending plan. And while in California, he's campaigning for Governor Gavin Newsom ahead of Tuesday's recall election. This from Axios.com, Secretary of State Antony Blinken delivered an unwavering defense of the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan on Monday, insisting it was time to end America's longest war, and praising the evacuation from Kabul as extraordinary. Blinken is the first senior official to testify on Afghanistan in the wake of the chaotic withdrawal. Here's part of his opening statement before the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
When President Biden took office in January, he inherited an agreement that his predecessor had reached with the Taliban to remove all remaining forces from Afghanistan by May 1st of this year. As part of that agreement, the previous administration pressed the Afghan government to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, including some top war commanders. Meanwhile, it reduced our own force presence to 2,500 troops. In return, the Taliban agreed to stop attacking U.S. and partner forces and to refrain from threatening Afghanistan's major cities. But the Taliban continued a relentless march on remote outposts, on checkpoints, on villages and districts, as well as the major roads connecting them. By January 2021, the Taliban was in the strongest military position it had been in since 9/11. And we had the smallest number of troops on the ground since 2001. As a result, upon taking office, President Biden immediately faced the choice between ending the war or escalating it. Had he not followed through on his predecessor's commitment, attacks on our forces and those of our allies would have resumed, and the Taliban's nationwide assault on Afghanistan's major cities would have commenced. That would have required sending substantially more U.S. forces into Afghanistan to defend themselves and prevent a Taliban takeover, taking casualties, and with at best the prospect of restoring a stalemate and remaining stuck in Afghanistan under fire indefinitely. There's no evidence that staying longer would have made the Afghan security forces or the Afghan government any more resilient or self-sustaining. If 20 years and hundreds of billions of dollars in support, equipment, and training did not suffice, why would another year, another five, another 10? Conversely, there is nothing that our strategic competitors like China and Russia, or adversaries like Iran and North Korea, would have liked more than for the United States to re-up a 20-year war and remain bogged down in Afghanistan for another decade.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The ranking Republican on the committee, Michael McCaul of Texas, asked him about how the U.S. will be able to monitor terror threats coming from a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan now that U.S. forces are no longer in that country.
My last question, very important. Bagram went down, the embassy went down, and we went dark. We have no eyes and ears on the ground. We've lost intelligence capability in the region. That includes Russia, China, and Iran, as you know. This is a national security threat as China moves in. For all I know, they may take over Bagram Air Base. But this over-the-horizon capability, I believe, is exaggerated. It's not a viable option. It's too far away. Did you negotiate with countries like Uzbekistan or Tajikistan to put an ISR capability there. And my last question, is it true that President Putin threatened the President of the United States, saying he could not build intelligence capabilities in the region?
This is an important question, and one that in its detail and substance I think we need to take up in another setting for reasons I know that you very much appreciate. Let me just say this very broadly, and you know this very well given your focus and expertise on these issues. The terrorist threat has metastasized dramatically over the last 20 years, and it's most acute in places like Yemen, like Libya, like Iraq, like Syria, like Somalia. And of course, we have much greater and different capabilities than we had 20 years ago in terms of dealing with that threat. And in many countries around the world, we deal with it effectively with no U.S. boots on the ground. We lost some capacity, for sure, in not having those boots on the ground in Afghanistan, but we have ways, and we are very actively working on that, to make up for that, to mitigate for that, to make sure that we have eyes on the problem, to see if it reemerges in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And to do something about it. But what I would propose,
and if I could reclaim, sir, I would like to work with you, because if we can't see what's happening on the ground, we can't see the threat, we can't respond to it, the threat's only going to grow, it's going to get worse, not better, and we have to have that capability. Let me ask you one last question. We had these planes grounded at Mazar-e-Sharif, and the Taliban seems to be holding these planes up. What are you currently negotiating with the Taliban with respect to these Americans that are trying to get out on these planes? And also, are you negotiating with the Taliban on the issue of legitimizing them as a real government?
Not only us, but virtually the entire international community, including in a United Nations Security Council resolution, has made clear what we expect and will insist on from the Taliban if they want to seek any legitimacy or any support. And that includes, it starts with, freedom of travel. So we've been intensely engaged with Turkey and Qatar to get the airport in Kabul up and running again, which is now the case. And we started to get flights out last week with American citizens on board. And with regard to Mazar-e-Sharif, you're correct. There have been charter flights there that have been there for some time that have not been allowed to leave. We want to see those flights leave. We need to see a process put in place to allow those flights to start to move.
Republican Congressman Michael McCaul questioning Secretary of State Antony Blinken. While both Republicans and Democrats in Congress have criticized in the past few weeks the Biden administration's handling of the frenzied and deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan, one Democrat today, Brad Sherman of California, pointed out that the Trump administration did not do the incoming Biden administration any favors, making it easier.
When you came into office on January 20th, we were committed to pulling everyone out of Afghanistan within 3 months, by May 1st. Did the Trump administration leave on your desk a pile of notebooks as to exactly how to carry out that plan? Did we have a list of which Afghans we were going to evacuate? Did we have a plan to get Americans from all over Afghanistan to Kabul and out in an orderly way? How meticulous was the planning for the Trump administration declared May 1st withdrawal?
Thank you, Congressman. We inherited a deadline. We did not inherit a plan.
So no plan at all. It's amazing that it wasn't much, much worse.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Congressman Brad Sherman, part of an hours-long hearing before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Adam Kinzinger, a Republican, asking the secretary about whether the U.S. should recognize the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan.
Let me ask you, though, Mr. Secretary, you know, you talk a little about the Taliban legitimacy, and we're going to see how they act. I want to ask you a question. Because I'm not sure where that changed. At the beginning of all of this, we were talking about building a worldwide coalition to not recognize the Taliban. And all of a sudden, this is on the table. Is the Taliban the legitimate government of Afghanistan? And if not, would you consider what the Taliban have done in Afghanistan to be a coup d'etat?
First, let me just start by thanking you for your strong words in support of the men and women of the State Department. I very much appreciate them and appreciate you saying them. Second, with regard to the Taliban and your question, it is the de facto government of Afghanistan. Those are just the facts. And
I don't mean to interrupt, but I need to. Is there has there been any discussion of an Afghan government in exile, vice president, even if the president had left? Is there any discussion of that? Because this to me appears to be an armed military coup against the legitimate elected government of Afghanistan.
Congressman, I will certainly look to see what the lawyers say. From where I sit, this is the product, alas, of one side getting the upper hand in a civil war.
Let me ask a couple of questions here on something too about that. So if we look at the list of new key players in the regime, we have the current prime minister who was deputy during the 9/11 attacks, the current deputy prime minister who served as number two defense official during the 9/11 attacks, the current foreign minister who's your counterpart was the Minister of Culture and Information during the 9/11 attacks. And we have designated terrorists in key positions like those that are responsible for preventing Afghanistan from becoming a safe haven in terror once again. So we look at that list and we see those individuals who not only defended al-Qaeda, but have committed crimes against women and vulnerable populations. And I think anybody look at that and say, this is the same regime that failed to hand over Osama bin Laden 20 years ago. But let me just ask you, have these individuals committed to denouncing al-Qaeda, to denouncing the Haqqani network, and ensuring that they will execute any attacks against them should they try to organize in their territory?
Well, in the agreement that was secured by the previous administration, the Taliban, now represented by these individuals, made commitments not to allow Afghanistan to be used as a launching ground for externally directed terrorism, whether by al-Qaeda or by anyone else. The big question now, and you're right to point to it, is whether they will make good on that commitment. But of course, we can't and won't rely on them to do that, even as we insist that they do.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. On Tuesday, he's before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, also on Afghanistan. We'll have live coverage at 10 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN radio, television, and listen anywhere on the free C-SPAN radio app. From the Wall Street Journal, the United Nations said Monday it obtained $1 billion in pledges of fresh funds to stave off a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan after receiving a written assurance by the Taliban authorities that they would allow aid workers to operate freely across the country. And this from Yahoo News, Afghan women have started an online campaign to protest against the Taliban's strict new dress code for female students, using hashtags like Do Not Touch My Clothes and Afghanistan Culture. Many are sharing pictures of their colorful traditional dresses. North Korean state media reporting today that that country had successfully launched newly developed long-range cruise missiles and calling them a strategic weapon of great significance. New York Times adding that it's the first missile test in 6 months and a new indication that an arms race between North and South Korea was heating up on the Korean Peninsula. A question to Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
Was the United States aware of that North Korean missile launch in advance?
I won't speak to intelligence activities, Jenny, or what we knew or what we didn't know. I mean, certainly we're aware of these reports of these cruise missile launches. We're going to continue to monitor the situation, and we're absolutely consulting with our allies and partners in the region. I think, without confirming specifics here, the activity itself certainly highlights the DPRK's continuing focus on developing its military program and the threats that it continues to pose to its neighbors and to the international community. And I think you heard Admiral Aquilino say pretty clearly last night that nothing's going to change about our commitment to the defense of Japan and South Korea. Those commitments are ironclad.
Do you think this is in violation of the UN Security Council resolution on sanctions against North Korea?
Yeah, I think I'm just going to defer on that right now. I mean, we're aware of these reports, and I'm not in a position to confirm the reports with any great specificity at this time. But again, I would just say it just highlights again the threat that the DPRK continues to pose to the region and to its neighbors.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. More from the New York Times article, a series of resolutions from the United Nations Security Council banned North Korea from developing or testing ballistic missiles, but not cruise missiles. This is Washington Today. CNBC reporting that House Democrats on Monday outlined a bevy of tax hikes on corporations and wealthy people to fund an investment in the social safety net and climate policy that could reach $3.5 trillion. The plan calls for top corporate and individual tax rates of 26.5% and 39.6% respectively, according to a summary release by the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee. Proposal includes a 3% surcharge on individual income above $5 million and a capital gains tax of 25%. Reaction from the White House: the Deputy Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, spoke with reporters on Air Force One.
Does the administration believe that the Ways and Means proposal goes far enough in taxing the wealthy, as the president had hoped?
So with the Ways and Means, since the campaign, President Biden outlined three basic principles for reforming the tax code. One was the middle class and working Americans are already paying enough. And so that's why the Build Back Better plan lowers taxes for over 50 million families through the child tax credit, earned income tax credit, and dependent tax credits. Two, we need to level the playing field for working families and small businesses so that profitable companies don't pay a lower tax bill than a nurse or teacher. And we'll do that in part by repealing the Trump tax cuts for the wealthiest households and most profitable corporations. And so three, the president will not raise taxes on anyone earning less than $400,000 per year. That's the basic goal, and the Ways and Means proposal are critical steps toward accompanying that. So we look forward to continue to work with our partners in Congress to reform the tax code and so that the highest income Americans and richest corporations pay their fair share. And so we see it as a first step.
Principal Deputy White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre holding what is called a gaggle with reporters as they traveled with the president on Air Force One. With more on the budget reconciliation bill, we spoke with Sarah Muha, politics reporter with Axios.
I think what we've seen from the White House, and something that they will double down on, is that they've been having conversations with members of the Senate and the House throughout this entire extremely long and strenuous process of building that infrastructure bill. So September 15th, that's just 2 days from now, Speaker Pelosi has created the self-imposed deadline of asking all the committees to compile and write the text of the infrastructure bill. And then September 27th is when the speaker promised moderates that they would, and the entire House, but specifically this was a promise made with moderates in mind, to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill by September 27th. This is, of course, a little bit tricky because they promised to bring up both the reconciliation package and the bipartisan infrastructure bill by the same day and vote on it at the same time. But right now it's looking a little sticky to see if they'll actually finish writing that reconciliation bill by that time.
Also, expectations that that $3.5 trillion figure may not be that figure at the end of the day.
No, absolutely. That's right. We heard Senator Joe Manchin say that figure is much too high. But then you have a split screen with Senator Bernie Sanders saying, well, we already compromised from $6 trillion, which, of course, no one realistically was ever going to vote for. Of course, progressives were going to, but that there was no chance of getting that passed with moderate Democrats. You had moderate Democrats in the House even coming out against that $6 trillion figure early on. So that's something that we're watching this week. We're going to see what number, and in the next couple of weeks, what number Democrats are able to land on where they can come to an agreement. But it's likely that this is going to be stretched out much longer than we anticipate.
Sarah Muha, then as we head into the fall months, as far as other agenda items, either from the White House or Democrats in Congress, what are we expected to see action on?
Well, there's a lot going on, right? This is an extremely busy next 2 weeks, particularly the government is set to run out of funding by September 30th. So Democrats and Republicans have to vote on continuing government funding, which could or could not include a debt ceiling raise. That's something that Democrats and Republicans are currently sparring on how to go about doing that. There's going to be potential funding for Hurricane Ida relief efforts that might be brought up to a vote. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, of course, said that she may bring up a vote regarding health restrictions for women in light of the Texas abortion ruling. Of course, that would likely, while it could pass the House, would have a much harder time passing in a tighter Democratic majority Senate. And then on top of all of that, of course, you have this going on against the backdrop of Afghanistan. And so while these aren't, of course, rulings, there are public hearings that could stretch out for weeks and months to come.
Sarah Muha, politics reporter with Axios, on this morning's Washington Journal on C-SPAN. And more on the congressional agenda when Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. Federal Election Commission ruling that Twitter did not break election laws last year when it blocked users from sharing links to a New York Post story about President Biden's son, Hunter Biden. And the Biden administration beginning to ask former inmates confined at home because of the coronavirus pandemic to formally submit commutation applications. That, according to a criminal justice reform advocate and an inmate telling Politico. Those who have been asked for the applications fall into a specific category, writes Politico. Drug offenders released to home under the pandemic relief bill known as the CARES Act, with 4 years or less on their sentences. From thehill.com, Congress returning to Washington after the week-long August recess with a laundry list of deadlines and priorities. The Democrats' to-do list includes voting rights, funding the government, raising the debt ceiling, must-pass defense bills, an abortion fight in the wake of the Supreme Court's Texas decision, and a high-profile grilling over the administration's messy Afghanistan withdrawal. Senate returns today. The House returns next week. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer opening today's session.
Of course, even as we work to deliver on our Build Back Better agenda, the House and Senate will also work on other important priorities that demand immediate attention, including passing a continuing resolution before the September 30th expiration of government funding, providing emergency funding to help those devastated by recent natural disasters, and helping resettle our Afghan allies and partners. I expect all of this to be done in a bipartisan and timely way. Of course, over the next few weeks, the House and Senate must also come together to address the debt ceiling. In America, when it's time to pay the bills, we follow through on our obligations without exception. For a long time, addressing the debt ceiling was considered a routine and responsible step that both sides worked together to achieve. Even when President Trump was in office, Democrats worked three times with Republicans to suspend the debt ceiling because it was the right and obvious thing to do. We didn't pick excuses and say, here's why we don't want to do it. We knew it was important, and it was time to lay aside differences and move it forward. But now, unfortunately, some of our Republican colleagues, even though they were eager to have Democrats support them when President Trump was president, have reportedly contemplating a reckless idea spearheaded by the Republican senator from Wisconsin to oppose any effort to raise the debt ceiling whatsoever. And unfortunately and sadly, the Republican leader seems to be going along. Let me be clear. Taking the debt hostage and playing games with the full faith and credit of the United States is reckless, irresponsible, and will harm every single American. It's a complete non-starter. This is not just another political debate. It's about honoring our unbroken commitment to pay our debts and avoid another financial crisis at a crucial moment for our country. Now, it's important to remember that this is not about greenlighting future spending. This is about paying debt from past spending, which was incurred during the Trump administration and which received favorable votes from a majority of Republicans and Democrats.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell followed.
Back in the springtime, Washington Democrats dumped trillions of dollars in liberal borrowing and spending onto the American people. They pretended it was a COVID relief bill. What it was a recipe for rampant inflation, a silent tax hike on American families. It was clear what would happen. Even liberal economists warned that this was a bad idea that would cause inflation. But just like in Afghanistan, Democrats had made up their minds long ago and were certainly not going to be deterred. Now, working Americans are paying the price. Annual inflation is up 5.4%, tied for the worst inflation in over a decade. It's more than swamped American workers' wage gains over the last year. The Democrats' inflation is turning Americans' workers' pay raises into effective pay cuts, essentially pickpocketing American families. You might think this would give our Democratic friends some pause and encourage them to deal in reality. But alas, that's not what's happening. Instead, they're eager to jam through yet another massive multi-trillion dollar reckless taxing and spending spree, an effort to move our country to the left, literally forever. Massive new government intrusion into America's childcare arrangements, into America's medical prescriptions, into the power grid, new welfare spending that hands out cash with zero work requirements, socialist price setting that would leave our medical system with fewer new cures, and 1,000 more awful far-left policies just like these, all accompanied by a suite of staggering, literally staggering tax hikes that would kill jobs, hurt families, and crush our competitiveness with the Chinese.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. NBC News writes the debt limit must be raised ahead of an October deadline, according to the Treasury Department, to avoid catastrophic economic consequences. We got more details from Shai Akabas, Director of Economic Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Let me start by saying that it's understandable that the average American has difficulty wrapping their head around what the debt limit is, because you wouldn't think that the U.S., one of the world's strongest economic powers, would be threatening to default on its debt annually or every 2 years. What we have right now is a situation where the federal government has a limit imposed by Congress on the amount of money that it borrows. Because we have annual deficits, we're not taking in as much money from taxes as we're spending. We have to increase our debt over time, and that means we have to borrow. But because we have the debt limit, which is a limitation on how much we can borrow, we're reaching a point now where the Treasury Department can't borrow the additional money it needs to pay all the bills and also service all the outstanding debt that we have. That's a problem. So what the Treasury Department is doing right now is using accounting maneuvers that are called extraordinary measures to buy a little bit of additional time for Congress to extend the debt limit. Congress often takes this to the deadline. And right now we expect that what we call the X date, which is when the government would no longer be able to make all of its obligations in full and on time, we expect that that's going to come sometime between mid-October and mid-November. So we could just be weeks away from a really catastrophic event.
So as you talked about the extraordinary measures being employed, that debt limit reached on August the 1st, I think $28.4 trillion. When it comes to that X date, how do you calculate that? What factors go into that?
We've been doing work on the federal debt limit since 2011. At that time, now Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was a visiting scholar with us, and I had the privilege of working with him closely on the model that he developed at the Bipartisan Policy Center to help us project when the debt limit would hit. Now, this is much more difficult than a lot of other kinds of forecasting because we are trying to estimate hundreds of millions of payments that come in and out of the government each month. That's not easy, and especially in a time when response to COVID is causing all sorts of variation, both in terms of spending that's going out on things like unemployment insurance benefits or small business loans, and on the revenue side and the tax side of the equation, where the economy is in this stage of recovery and we don't know how strong those revenues are going to be going forward. So we try to look at all of those payments and figure out how big the hole is and when that hole will mean that the federal government has run out of room to borrow. And that means that it's run out of these accounting maneuvers and the Treasury Department has run out of its cash on hand, its cash reserves to pay the bills. And at that point, we would reach the X date, where the government would have to find some way to fund some of its obligations, but that would really be unprecedented.
Walk us through a scenario where the X date is reached and bypassed without some type of resolve from Congress.
So the story here is really all about risk, because we've never been in a situation in modern history where the United States is not able to pay all of its bills. So I have to emphasize that this would be a really serious situation. And there's an incredible amount of uncertainty because we've never been there before. We posted a blog at the Bipartisan Policy Center that tried to walk through some of the ramifications and especially some of the implications for the average American. The first is that out of those hundreds of millions of payments that I mentioned earlier, many of them would not be made on time. So if you're expecting a check from the federal government, that could be in the form of a child tax credit payment, the monthly payments that are now going out. It could be unemployment insurance benefits. It could be some type of business loan. That could all be interrupted if we go past the X date. The federal government would be in a position where it's either picking and choosing which payments go out the door, or more likely it could be delaying all payments except for interest and principal on the federal debt until Congress resolves the issue. So that's number one, is that it could mean missed payments for people who are expecting them. The second is that it could have a dramatic effect on interest rates, because investors, seeing that the US is not paying its bills, might start insisting on higher interest rates to hold US debt. And that could have ramifications throughout the economy, because interest rates on everything from mortgages to car loans, many other things, are based on US Treasury rates. So that could mean higher interest rates over the coming months and years, even if we got into a situation where the US wasn't paying all of its bills.
Shaya Kabas is Director of Economic Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, joining C-SPAN on Monday morning's Washington Journal program. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 261, NASDAQ down 9, S&P up 10. Turning to the coronavirus pandemic, top White House advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci says he would support a vaccine requirement for air travel. He tells the Skims podcast, if you want to get on a plane and travel with other people, then you should be vaccinated. And two longtime Food and Drug Administration officials leading the agency's review of COVID-19 vaccine applications and who are leaving the agency have now co-authored a medical article in The Lancet arguing that there's no need for booster shots in the general population. Neither Marion Gruber nor Phil Krause speaking publicly about their reasons for leaving, but there's been some speculation the Biden administration's push for booster shots was part of it. Members of the United States Capitol Police were seen installing surveillance cameras around the area of the U.S. Capitol Monday morning, writes WUSA-TV, Channel 9 in Washington. Some areas near the Capitol have already been boarded up, and several robotic cameras were placed at different locations. This comes as authorities prepare in anticipation of a September 18th protest organized by supporters of January 6th defendants. The rally, known as Justice for J6, is planned for the Union Square area of the Capitol grounds, the section of the West Front encompassing the Ulysses S. Grant Memorial and Capitol Reflecting Pool. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger briefed congressional leaders on security plans. He then told reporters the fence surrounding the U.S. Capitol, put up after the January 6th attack by supporters of President Trump, is going back up ahead of Saturday's rally.
Yeah, we just briefed them about the demonstration that's scheduled for September 18th, just the intelligence information that we're aware of and a little bit about our operational plan, about what we plan to do.
Have you requested that the fence be removed?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Has that been approved yet?
Yes.
When will it go up?
The fence will go up a day or two before, and if everything goes well, it'll come down very soon after.
So. You, as well as the sergeant-at-arms leaders, briefing the members?
Yes, that's correct.
Do you have more briefings before?
Yes, we will. We're going to do a press briefing a day or two before the event. So thank you all very much.
Are any members going to attend those meetings?
U.S. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer telling reporters after today's security briefing, they seemed very, very well prepared, much better prepared than before January 6th. I think they're ready for whatever might happen. CNN reporting that U.S. Capitol Police say they arrested a California man who had multiple knives in his truck, which had a swastika and other white supremacist symbols painted on it near the Democratic National Committee headquarters early Monday morning. The knives included a bayonet and machete, which are illegal in the District of Columbia.
God bless America, land that I love.
Members of the U.S. Army Band, Pershing's Own, part of today's ceremony on the east front steps of the U.S. Capitol building, marking the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks. This from Roll Call, explaining that that song has become an unofficial part of the Capitol's observance of 9/11 and dates back to the evening of 9/11 itself in 2001, when members and leadership gathered on the East Front just hours after the attacks. The four bipartisan leaders of the House and Senate speaking today. Here is Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
President Lincoln cautioned against the silent artillery of time. The harsh artillery of time eroding our memory. Today and always, we renew our vow. Time shall not dim the memory of our fallen heroes. We pray that the years might ease the pain of the bereaved, but never the luster of the deeds of the fallen. When we visit the memories of September 11th, we tread on sacred ground. As we all know, 20 years ago, on that clear Tuesday morning, America was forever changed by an act of terrorism. In a moment, nearly 3,000 lives were taken, and the innocence of a generation was lost. Yet at our darkest moment, America showed the world our greatness. In the heroism of the first responders who rushed into danger, in the strength of strangers bonded by the loss, in the courage of a nation that found unity in our agony. As Americans across the country mark this solemn day over the weekend, we recommit to our sacred promise to never forget both what we lost and the unity and strength that we found. May God bless the families of those who lost their loved ones, those who helped those families, and may God bless America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Also with some remarks about the remembrance, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
20 years ago, we saw true evil, an evil that tried to destroy us. But good people become heroes in hard times. And that's how the American people responded, heroically. We rallied around the principles of freedom that came under attack. We comforted families, friends, and neighbors. Churches flung open their doors, and we flocked in, calling out to God for help and hope. We had the sense to know there was something more important than politics. We stood together, united, proud to be Americans. We flew the American flag in homes across the country to honor the first responders who lost their lives and to celebrate the undying American values that a cowardly act of terrorism could not extinguish. That is a record of how a dark hour of American history became one of our finest hours. The cowards who wanted to destroy our way of life tried to break our spirit. Instead, they revealed that those who live in freedom have a rare reservoir of strength that nobody else has. 2 decades later, we continue to mourn the victims and honor our heroes. We cannot mourn without honoring. And we cannot honor without resolving to do everything we can to prevent another terrorist attack on American soil. Together, we can continue to honor the memories of the fallen by making Never Forget a 365-day commitment. It is up to us, everyone, to make this pledge meaningful.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Today's ceremony on the steps of the U.S. Capitol also included a moment of silence. Gray News writes, the event caps a weekend of solemn remembrances. Saturday, on the anniversary of the terror attacks that killed 3,000, President Joe Biden visited the sites in New York, Pennsylvania, and outside Washington where the four hijacked planes crashed. Biden stood next to former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton at the National September 11th Memorial in Manhattan at the former site of the World Trade Center, as the names of the dead were read aloud by their loved ones. Former President George W. Bush delivering the keynote address at the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. decried the current acrimony in the nation and compared domestic terrorists to those who attacked on 9/11. Today, former President Donald Trump put out a statement that reads, "So interesting to watch former President Bush, who is responsible for getting us into the quicksand of the Middle East and then not winning, as he lectures us that terrorists on the right are a bigger problem than those from foreign countries that hate America and that are pouring into our country right now. He shouldn't be lecturing us about anything." Thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. And for more top Washington stories, subscribe to our evening newsletter, Word for Word, at c-span.org/connect. I hope you have a good evening.